Tom Donahue.
I don't see it. It just seems to me that Phoenix constantly is a victim of its own syntax.
Okay. It's okay.
Terrible. The term that they use for all other words, eliminated, was that it?
Neutralizations. Well, they started out with eliminations, and then it became neutralizations.
Well, I had more more trouble with people who could only interpret that word to mean one thing, which was really kind of madness, I thought. People were sitting around drawing up death lists and executing people, which seemed it was clearly at that point. Anybody in the United States wouldn't believe any enormity about what was going on in Vietnam. There's just no question. I can cite three instances where I was here in Washington. I was summoned summarily up to the Hill, and one session with a congressman. It was, I think, 45 minutes before I could get a word out. I was so mad.
Simply because he would not take no for an answer that these people were out there running some sort of a book and all.
So you did do some testifying on...
No. This is by God in his office, by God.
Okay, all right, this is... I see. Because there were hearings, too, and a lot of people were marching in front of the hearings.
No, I never testified, but it was just the questions. And clearly, there was no... I knew... absolutely no way that I was ever going to convince that gentleman.
No.
And the best I could do was hope to back out of his office before he had a stroke.
Well, this is one of the things that, as a writer, was interesting to me, was Phoenix as a symbol. And I think that one of the... If the problem with Phoenix is its syntax, then its biggest syntactical problem is its name, Phoenix. Okay, which is a sinister kind of a name. Okay, and so if, as a writer, names for me evoke archetypes and they affect people in that way, and that's why Phoenix is interesting. And so, of course, maybe the big problem was the name itself. Anyway, I have some prepared questions. Can I start with them? Could you perhaps tell me a little bit about your background, where you went to school? Your either military career or intelligence career?
I went to a place called Columbia.
Okay. And are you a World War II veteran?
Yes. Air Force. Okay.
And did you join the agency in 47 in the beginning?
No. I came out of graduate school and joined the agency in 52.
Any personal reasons for wanting to get into intelligence work?
Not personal reasons. It was simply, I think, the question of... if you've been around in 52, it was a pretty sinister time. I was telling my wife the other day, it was rather interesting, that the summer session of 1950 in Columbia, you may or may not recall, a thing called the Korean War started in June. The numbers of cancellations of people around the country, this is particularly true of their teachers' college, of course, that canceled and were not going to show up in New York because New York obviously was ground zero for the bomb.
The bomb. Okay.
Now these are educated people. These are people doing their doctoral and master's work at a place like Columbia that obviously just must have thought that we wouldn't make it through the summer.
I assume that the Rosenberg case or something, that the Russians had just gotten the bomb at this point. Is that what happened?
No, the Korean War started. You know, there was an awful lot of heavy talk
at that point, or the other, if we were having little dust-ups with the Yugoslavs and various little things going on, and when the situation in Europe was beginning to show that we were pretty well locked into a situation that was getting worse, as it was, 48, 49, 50. So, I think there was a great feeling amongst a lot of people that we were in for a thing that did become the Cold War, and which, thank God, was contained. But at that point, no one could really tell what the outcome. I thought it just seemed to me that for the foreseeable future, like it or not, the problems in Europe, Asia, the problems that we were having, certainly would have with the Soviets. As you know, the Chinese have just 49.
It's just,
the Jinmo just moved to Taipei. So it looked like it was a growth industry.
Okay. I think that has proven to be such. Okay, I don't think anybody could have had any idea it would become so big. Can you tell me in a few words how your career moved you from getting into the agency to Vietnam?
Oh, I can't really in specifics, other than that I'm very much interested in Asia. Always have been.
When you were in the Air Force in World War II, were you in Asia?
No.
Okay. Was your study at Columbia about Asia?
Comparative literature.
And can you tell me when it is that you get to Vietnam and in what capacity?
Yeah, I went to Vietnam in summer of 64.
Okay. And were you part of the station?
Yeah. I took over amongst other things a lot of responsibilities that I had, and I it included a small training camp down in Vung Tha, which had, I suppose, maybe 100 students, run by a very dynamic guy.
Was that Bob Eschbach?
No, Americans there. This is, I'm talking about Vietnamese.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Would that have been Chow?
No. Chow was much later. This is Lê Duẩn Mai.
Oh, okay.
He was a very dynamic, bright, capable guy.
And
it was small. Display. What it had been, it was a camp that had been owned by what the devil was it? That doesn't matter.
Was he Vietnamese?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was a. He was a politician. He was a. What he had done is he had interest in Vung Tha, and they had a, what the hell do you call it, a workers something or other, that kept the road from Vung Tha open on, with troops on weekends so that, the French could put it down and people could use the Vung Tha resort facility.
Okay.
So this was his camp just outside of Vung Tha.
Now, is this camp where the airport is, which was Cap Saint Jacques? Is it the same facility?
No. This is another one.
Okay.
But this guy had been thrown in the pokey by the ZM, and
my.
No.
The politician.
Yeah, the politician. So, the camp was sort of up for grabs, and we got it. We the station. In a deal, and had Mai there on loan from the army. He was a captain, and another captain. What the hell was his name? Captain
Phoc. Phoc. Phoc.
Phoc. Phoc. Another one.
Oh, okay.
And they toured around the camp. We had an Australian army captain who was seconded to the station. And he was running it as a Western presence. And I went down and took a look at it and what they were doing, and I was mighty impressed.
Can you tell me who the Australian was? Do you remember? Not Bernard, was it?
No, I had 13 Australian seconded. Oh, I may or may not think of it.
Okay. How big of a facility was Vung Tau at that time?
Oh, it was small. We probably had maybe 100 students at the time.
And these are people for RevDev, Revolutionary Development
Students? This is an early program called the Armed Propaganda Teams. And these are small. These were 12, 14 man teams. They're trained in small unit tactics, mostly evasive tactics. But their basic thrust was in propaganda.
Okay, now...
They were Mai was a wizard at appealing to a particular sensory element that Vietnamese seemed to have. About the fatherland and all sorts of the ability to to interweave Vietnamese myth and modern day nationalism that seemed somehow to make an impact on the tutored and the untutored as well. So I spent a lot of time with Mai finding out what he was all about, and I was mighty impressed, so I just went back and I gradually decided that this was the route that I thought we should be going.
Okay, can you give me, is it okay to give me an example of what these people were trained in, what a particular tactic would be?
Oh, yeah, well, basically, they were just trained in light weapons. We had, they had men and women. And their military side was really pretty minimal. It was really just, how to defend yourself before you get the hell out of there.
And that would be what the Aussie would be teaching, would be the
yeah,
weapons.
That's right.
And
sure,
that.
Sure.
But Mai would be teaching the political.
That's right.
What about the political? What
well,
is
we
it?
Had we had political stuff. We had medical. We had some warrant officers, I guess, from Harbin that were seconded to us, and they were teaching all sorts of first aid, sanitation, the gals primarily were concerned with children's simple illnesses and diseases and with midwifery and whatever else. It was really pretty much of an armed social working element, which was pretty much the basic thrust of the whole thing. From that point, the program evolved rapidly. We developed some interest on the part of our management. I saw was well worthwhile. I concentrated just about all my efforts and got rid of most of the other stuff that we had responsibilities for. And we began to move very, very rapidly. We began to build up the program with more officers coming from Washington, PCS.
Permanent change of station.
Yeah. Then I began looking for a means of expanding it. My opposite number in the government was the Minister of Security, I guess. Is that right? Justice, Security.
There's Interior, there's Justice.
Interior Minister, pardon me.
Okay.
Interior Minister.
Because I think Minister of Interior handles security.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I went.
Do you remember who that was?
Oh, listen, there were 13 governments in 18 months. How the hell could I
Okay. All right. Forgive me for asking, but I...
My official act was to make a call on the minister, whoever he was that week.
Okay.
Introduce myself, brief him, and when he found out that there was nothing he could steal from me or any hashish in it, I was dismissed, and that was the end of that. It was a very nice arrangement. But the first guy I had, and I kind of got interested in him, he was a... He was a big VNQDD, long time political, and he hung around long enough to see if there wasn't something he could get out of me. And I said, I worked out a deal with him that I wanted space at Von Taub, and he said fine. So I worked out a deal of getting a huge hunk of the peninsula ceded to me with the official chops and the whole schmear, which obviously much later became very, very popular, very, very much salivated after.
Because of their...
Oh, it's location, it's safety.
Okay.
God!
Okay.
So we began to develop the concept of putting a train program together, expanding it. During that summer, we had some units up north, not many, but we had some up in Da Nang. Quang Nai, of course, was the was a good one because it was run by a smart guy. It was so goddamn bad up in Quang Nai in those days.
Now, can we stop for a minute?
Sure.
I know I did an interview with Frank Scott. Was that, and we spent 7 hours talking about 62 to 65. And he was in Quang Nai. Are you talking about the program he was running up there?
Well.
Or him and Bob Kelly? And
it's
those people? Was that the...
Well, it was kind of an interesting situation. Frank was up there with Kelly. And, we had a guy up there,
Ralph Johnson?
Ralph.
Okay.
And one of our Australians was sent up there, Ian T.
Mm-hmm.
Ian was an exceptionally effective military officer. He was bright as hell. He was imaginative, industrious, and awfully good at training. So the basic unit that evolved was simply, a small unit couldn't survive up there.
Mm-hmm.
Quang Nai really was just the jaws of the Lord. So sagely, Ian had just expanded his team to a much, much larger size unit. His equipment was a little bit heavier than they had in the units down south. Frank was very helpful. Kelly, Ralph Johnson, who had done a lot of things, this sort of stuff, was a very imaginative guy. So, but the strength of the team came out of Ian.
Okay. At least in Quang Nai, or
well, that's
throughout the country.
No. That was pretty much just in Quang Nai. Yeah.
Okay.
But
Ralph Johnson is deceased, and before he died, he wrote a dissertation, which is at American University on Phoenix, which I've read, which I have a copy of, which you can get through University Microfilms for $30. But I can't get any biographical information on Ralph Johnson. Can you give me some? Did you know him well enough to give me some biographical information on him? I mean, I believe I know he was in the 18th Air Corps or something like that in World War II. No?
Yeah, Ralph was a pilot in...
or was it Flying Tigers?
From Chicago, Edison.
Was he a long-time CIA person?
From
the beginning?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And with maybe a couple of years' experience in Vietnam, was he? Had he been there, or did he come in maybe 62, 63?
Oh, Christ.
Any idea? Maybe when William Colby first was station chief there?
No, he had been, he'd also been in Laos, so I'm not sure the exact dates, but he was in Vietnam a hell of a long time.
Okay.
And then he went back again. He left in about 65, I was back on Vietnam in summer 67, and he was back then PCSA.
Okay.
I have no idea how many years in this has been.
Okay. When did you start your expanding the facility at Vung Tau? Is that summer, fall of 64?
Yeah.
Summer 64. Okay. And when you say you got a couple of people from Washington PCS, how many?
Oh, I got gobs of people.
Gobs, okay. Dozens? Well, two dozen, maybe?
Yeah. What I did was, I was able to, there was a Catholic seminary at Vung Tau. I think it was Vincentian, I'm not mistaken, but it was a Canadian order that owned it.
Okay.
And they decided it was time to cut and run. So I found out that the seminary was on the block. And so we arranged to buy it. So we had a camp that would handle, I suppose almost, I've forgotten how many people we put in there. But it was an ideal situation. Bam,
yeah, it's like having a hotel right in your...
Just exactly.
Okay. Is there an individual who is in charge of your training program, apart from you?
I had, of course, I've been a variety of people. I had stayed. I got my promotion out of the military, which was like volunteer, so he became a major. I had a guy that was active in our training that came out, maybe three or four people that participated in our training that came out to run the camp. I had a guy who has been training agency people and all sorts of things.
Was Tucker Googleman one of the people?
No, Tucker was not there that early. Tucker was in another program. He was in the police side of the thing. There were two major programs in the station. One was the police and the other was the cadre program. I had the cadre program, and then later Tucker took over that program. But to me, at that point, he was up in Da Nang.
Okay. Was Bill Riddell in on at this time?
No, Bill came much later.
Okay. Because Riddell is another name that Evan Parker gave to me, but Riddell's in Hawaii and it's going to be difficult for me to get out there.
That's where he is.
But, okay, so then you get maybe two dozen instructors and they are also, and now you're, instead of having 100 students, you're going to have maybe 1,000 students?
Well, what we did is we Well, we bought the seminary. The seminary was really, it was just a stopgap. I had this huge piece of property. So then we started building a camp. So we built a camp for $5,000.
In that plot that you had bought?
Okay. So we had ample training space, plenty of training space.
Now, is that a little bit north, a little bit south?
It's just off the main road.
Okay. Adjacent.
It's beyond the airport.
Okay. It's not. Is it a helicopter ride to get there?
Or is it
a walk? Okay.
Drive. Cars. Okay. We built roads. We built the whole thing.
Okay. And how long does it take you to complete that?
I'll tell you, we built that in. I think we opened that up the 15th of January.
65.
Okay. It was a hell of a building. Spectacular, really.
So it's basically one building?
No, Lord, no.
Okay, all right.
No, we had barracks and mess halls and classrooms and armories and offices.
Okay.
We still had seminary, which gave us, you know, the ability to have a good permanent base.
Is that seminary also at your administrative center?
Yeah, we would keep that stuff there. But hell, we had huge latrines. And, 5,000 people.
Okay, that's 5,000 students.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. And so you're ready for business in January?
Oh, no. We were teaching all along.
We just
continued whatever space we had. We were continuing to use old Cat Low, which was the original camp.
Can you give me a spell?
Yeah, C-A-T, new word, L-O.
Okay. You wouldn't happen to, in any of your scrapbooks, have any photographs of this that I could see, would you? Maybe the end, when this is over?
Let me think.
Sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words.
Yeah.
Okay. Is your own personal headquarters there, or is your headquarters in Saigon?
No, I was in Saigon.
And you would drive down and make sure everything's going?
Drive? Are you out of your mind?
Fly now.
That's right.
Okay.
Nobody drove in those days.
Because 65 is the bad time. This is after all the coups and when the Viet Cong are everywhere.
Well,
right.
After, certainly, 64, 65, you weren't driving very many places in South Vietnam. Now, what we were doing, you see, the whole point of this was to use these people. So my job, I was also at the same time traveling the country, selling the program to province.
Okay, this is what Jim West said. Jim West said to me that, and Ward said, after the failure of Strategic Hamlet program, you came along and you sold the program to all the different province chiefs. Is that's a fair summation of what happened?
It's exactly what it was. I'd get up I'd go in and sit down with the province chief. I worked the whole country.
Why the province chiefs? Why not the military generals? Why is it?
They were as bad as our military. They never understood what we were doing.
And the province chiefs being the extension of the GVN, and at this time under Key, I suppose, or pretty close to under Key.
Well, all through that period, whoever was in charge made my job that much easier because the rat lines had long since disappeared.
Okay.
So when I went in to see a province chief, I would go in to see a military officer who was a product of a mandarinal system who didn't have a political bone in his body, but had political responsibilities that were beginning to become apparent even to the untutored. So my deal was to go in and say, if I got a deal for you. No, I really did go in and say, look, this is the problem, as we see it, that you're facing. The next line down is district.
Yeah.
Under the mandarinal system, which everyone accepted, it was nobody's business in the province what was done. It was the province chief when they had been civilians, and the district chief when they had been civilians, were supplanted by military.
Mm-hmm.
But for generations and generations, centuries and centuries, what was done whatever funds were around were expended the way the whoever was the leader thought they should be expended. Okay. And he really couldn't care less about what some grubby little old peasant lady in black pajamas had to say.
It was the king's influence ends at the village gate. That system. And you're trying to get them over that system. That's to right. Say that you got to get in there to those in the inside that village gate because that's where the Viet Cong are. Okay. And the way to do that is to have these RD cadre go in. Okay. And
start learning what the hell your political problems are and start paying attention and act as though you cared.
Okay.
So my deal was this. I said, look, we do this on a handshake, old boy.
Okay.
If you're willing to enter into a program whereby you use these people in the way where they've been trained and the way we have designed the program, we will feed them, pay them, equip them, just as long as they're used properly.
Mm-hmm.
If you decide at any time that they're a hindrance rather than a help, you give me a call, 30 days, we'll get them out of here. If I decide that you're not using them properly, or they're being misused, that you're using them as a palace guard here in the province, or whatever, I will give you 30 days' notice and pull them out.
Okay.
And that was the agreement. It was that simple. Nothing in writing, nothing went through the central government. I had the central government approval on this, period.
Right.
Go and do as you see fit.
Okay.
So it was a splendor. So what I would then do is I would take an agency officer and stick him in the province.
Okay.
And tell him, find a place to live, get some sandbags, we'll try to get you some known guards, stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was responsible for direction of the teams, payroll, logistics, the whole thing.
Okay, now is this officer different than your special branch officer in the province?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, these guys work for me.
Okay. But they would be talking with one another and so as not to trip over each other's feet or something
like
that.
Well, you see, the police guys mm-hmm. in the province were were trying to set up interrogation centers and they were trying to utilize train the local officials, provincial officials, in the collection of intelligence.
And this is what Tucker was doing at that time. He's setting up the PIC program and special branch.
Well, he had kind of a regional responsibility in Da Nang. Okay. And then I've forgotten exactly when Tucker was pulled back to Saigon to run the overall program for the police. Mm-hmm. We had you mentioned Chow earlier. Well, Chow, mm-hmm. of course, was a very far-sighted and a very bright guy with a great ability, I should say, rather, to keep statistics, meaningful statistics, which is not very Vietnamese. They just like statistics. He ran all sorts of experimental programs in Kinh Hoa, and which was it was a dreadfully complex province. He had been there a long time. He had been the apple of Tsien's eye during the Strategic Hammer program,
mm-hmm.
and he had the special phone to the palace, sort of thing. Tsien would be on the horn doing constantly.
And then
what he was able to do, because he had that sort of sponsorship, he was able to do an awful lot of experimentation. And basically, he was the sort of a guy that really was interested in the political aspects. He was most farsighted in that. A terrible prima donna. He was from Hue, very arrogant. Interesting duck. I liked him very much. But what we would do is then is this, very simple. We would say, okay, here is a guy that you can trust. Here is a guy that is imaginative. Here's a guy that's got programs that we think are good. He had a lot that weren't, obviously, but he was willing to scrap them. So we use this as an experimental province. So I'd spent a lot of time between Mai and Chow looking at the programs, trying to introduce refinements, my own political aspects into it. So we were able to develop, I think, we saw eye to eye on what was what should be done.
Can you tell me a little bit about what these particular programs were?
Oh, sure.
Okay. You know, I mean, is it... Well, you tell me. Okay.
Well, in Kinhua, obviously, we had small teams. We later beefed them up as the training became a possibility. But, let me think. Well, census grievance, for example, started in Kinhua. Census grievance was probably the most sophisticated program in the whole goddamn country. I think it's spectacular.
I'd love to hear about it.
It's the most effective political tool. If you accept the fact that the government really didn't care what people thought, what their political needs were, not because they were callous, because it was an entirely different system.
I understand.
And if you were the product of a military academy, you were part of that elite. And so you just continue to perpetuate a system that where the lines had been cut. The Viet Cong were able to do this. They were so effective, because you know when they moved back into the villages after partition, they were able to move in and very very skillful use of terror. I mean, I think people made a lot of it, but they used it very very effectively to demonstrate. You know, if there was anybody that was really pro government, let's eliminate him. But better, let's really eliminate the corrupt. Let's really eliminate. So you had these two targets.
Mm-hmm.
And
when they were the same, it worked out very well for them.
And save on bullets.
Yeah, right, okay.
So what you had was a system in the villages then there that they were really effectively cut off.
Okay.
The rat lines up had gone. The government no longer had a line for district down. So in effect, when that line was cut, you had really, the population had been really cut adrift.
Okay. You say a rat line?
Well, I mean, lines. It's the sort of lines that you would have in any political situation.
It's just a phrase I haven't heard before.
I didn't mean it in that sense. Yeah. But a line of communication is really what I'm saying.
Okay.
So the basic point would be, we need X in this village. We have always needed, when I remember my daddy talked, a bridge across this particular canal would save us a 3-mile walk to get our products to market. Mm-hmm. We'd get a better price. We don't get, what do we get? We get something we don't want.
Okay.
Very legitimate needs.
Now, how do you set up, what's your model for census grievance that's developed in Kinhua?
All right, census grievance is right. Everybody knows that governments always take the census.
Okay.
You go back to Bethlehem. So what's better than to set up a census? Okay. So you have a guy who would do a map of every house, hut in the village, put everything into perspective, and then the edict was put out that once a month, every head of household had to talk to the census grievance officer.
Okay. Now, and that's a member of your armed propaganda team at this point?
No, well, basically what we did in Kinhua, we had a special group that ran census grievance. What we tried to do was to get somebody who was from the village, someone who was an older, we were looking for retired teachers We were looking for retired civil servants. We're getting older people, which made them all the more harmless in the eyes of anybody.
The teeth were gone. Would they be people who were also on the village council? Or
conceivably, yes. But people with some older but respected.
Okay.
So it basically they the session scaled down and had three questions. Number one,
okay.
What would you like the government of Vietnam to do for you? And here you get the simplest of things. You get the bridge, you get a road, you get whatever, a sanitation problem, some help with a claim against the government that they've been ignored. All of the basic precinct type needs. I might point out to you that I grew up in a place called Cook County.
In Illinois?
Yes. So this was in my blood.
Ward politics.
What's that? Yeah. 44th Ward. 31st precinct.
Okay.
I can remember, my father was a precinct captain, I remember so well, taking me during the Depression days, getting welfare stuff through, getting, somebody even should have had a load of coal from welfare, they didn't have it, the house was cold, and they'd be around to see my father.
Go. Yeah.
Day, night, Saturday, anytime.
How politics has changed.
That's right. I sit here. Nobody ever knocks on this door.
Yeah, well, TV has made the ward person obsolete. My grandmother from down in New York City told me they remember the car coming around to pick people up and take them to the voting booth.
We would check by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Anybody that hadn't voted, we were out ringing the bell.
Mm-hmm.
If they were sick or if they needed help or something, needed somebody to sit and watch the kids or whatever, but get them there before the polls.
That's why only 37% of people vote nowadays.
Right. The point was,
if they could vote through the TV, they would vote. If they didn't have to get up and go down and they vote through the TV.
AC Nielsen should work something out through the passive voting. But at any rate, the second question census people all would ask is there anybody in the GVN giving you a hard time?
Okay. Is the policeman taking money from you when you go to market?
Right. Are you being, that's exactly, are you paying little, little toll every time you have to take your rutabagas in.
Okay.
And, so you've asked the first question. If this guy listens and he finds that X number of the people say, Jesus, we really do need a bridge, or we need a this, or we need... You begin to get a consensus.
Okay.
Okay, there is money allocated. There is no question that the U.S. government was pouring money into that place. But if, as long as it went for the wrong things, you might just as well have kept it back here. So the point that we would make with the province chief and with the district chief is that, okay, this is what is actually needed. This is a political need. If you are responsive to it, people will look at you in a different light. Okay. So we were running a coaching school for army officers, for district chiefs and for province chiefs.
Did you have a personal staff that would travel around with you?
I had a deputy and I had a chief of operations.
Okay.
And this was it's a very large operation. We're talking in terms of. But of course,
in budget, how big?
Oh, I suppose somewhere between I've never told anybody this figure before. I don't know why.
That's okay. I mean,
when I left Vietnam, my budget was about $28 million a year.
Big country, I could see where you would need that much. I mean, it doesn't sound.
I know it doesn't. But I had about 120
20 offers.
American. Yeah.
But you know, your budget gets tied up in airtime, all sorts of costs.
Because you had to do a contract with AA every year, and you had to do...
Oh, hell, because they were moving goods and services all over the country. I mean, all, we, but we would... The thing about the agency that, that most people don't realize is it was a bloody efficient place.
I've been finding that out. I did an interview with a man named Nelson Brickham, who...
Oh, yeah, I knew him.
Okay, and he was explaining, you know, how just how tight the reporting system is, and how he had written up, he had set up a reporting system for province officers, which would take him 2 or 3 days a month just to fill out and complete. That's how tight the reporting systems was. So I'm beginning to understand that that's why it was efficient. Did you have reporting systems for your people?
My point, of course, was quite the opposite of Brigham's.
Okay.
I felt that to keep those guys working, don't tie them up with paperwork. No, basically, that could be done. You can do the... So what I would take raw reporting, and then I had an officer that I'd been given that was who's not really any good in the field, but I had this one officer responsible for nothing but finished reporting from raw reporting.
Okay.
So you take that sort of a problem off of guys.
I see.
And so I find that they're really valuable. And of course, this is the same problem that so many sales organizations have. If they want their people off the street report.